With uncertain steps, the little boy toddled past the storage jars lined up in the hallway. He stumbled over a bump on the uneven floor and fell, but caught himself. He drew himself up again, never giving up. Walking a few more steps, the little boy looked around, and then he noticed. His face broke into a joyous smile. He turned, and as fast as his little legs could carry him, he made his way to his father. Arms outstretched, the little boy did not fall as he negotiated the uneven floor. He demanded to be lifted up. His father gathered the little boy up in his arms. "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom," David held him tightly, ruffled his curls. The little boy chattered with delight in unintelligible words that the father could nevertheless understand. David walked with Absalom through the house. Now that David's days of wandering were over, David had settled into Hebron as a king of Judah. Here he finally had found rest. Here he finally had a family as sons and daughters were born to his wives. Absalom's mother was Maakah, the beautiful princess from the kingdom of Geshur, the first foreign princess that David married. David remembered those days in Hebron fondly. They were simple compared to the splendor of the Jerusalem court, where he moved as king over all Israel. In Jerusalem, the heavy burdens of his office and his family affairs weighed heavily on David. David could still see the little boy when he thought of Absalom, the son whom he had given the name Father of Peace, because at that time, David, he himself was at peace. He had been sure that Absalom would grow to be a man of peace. How had it all ended up so wrong? Wasn't it his own, David's fault, that Absalom had turned against him? Had David not only unwittingly facilitated the rape of Absalom's sister, but more so, had he not failed to bring any consequences to bear on the offender? Was it a wonder that, with justice denied, Absalom had turned against his father's family and eventually had fled to his mother's relatives? And had David not been unreasonable by promising Absalom reconciliation, only to have him wait around in Jerusalem for 2 whole years before Absalom was admitted into the royal family again? Had David not set an example by killing those who opposed him, by taking with force what he thought was his? Did Absalom learn that deceit and mistrust from his father? Where had the beautiful boy gone? In all this, David could see his own guilt. And so David grieves at the news of Absalom's death. "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." The grief is real, and tangled up with it all is David's regret, David's shame, David's guilt. Now it was too late for reconciliation. It was too late for honest conversations. It was too late for justice. It was too late to show his son that he loved him. Well, of course, we don't know exactly why David grieved so deeply at the death of his son, but it might have been for those reasons. And we do know from experience that parents normally take the loss of a child quite heavily. But, of course, not all loss is the same. Not all grief can be described by a simple formula. Relationships between people differ. Emotions differ. Death is never pleasant, but we know that some people's lives are cut short in what we consider the prime of their lives. Others finally find rest after a time of suffering, when death has been knocking on the door for years. Some die at peace with the world. Others die in bitterness. Our response may be different in each situation. Some grieve relationships and times that have long passed. Other people grieve connections that have lasted a lifetime. And yet others have only recently come to know the person that has been taken from them. The circumstances of our loss are all different, and so is our response. There is no uniform process of how we deal with our grief. In the last century, that's the 20th century, the concept of stages of grief became quite popular. And for some, this model may be helpful, especially by acknowledging that some of the responses that we might have are natural and understandable. The model becomes more problematic if we expect that every grieving process must follow these stages. And yet, there's also a certain shared human experience in our loss. Loss is as much part of human life as birth. For to greater or lesser extent, we all suffer loss on this earth. Now, I want to explore some of the responses to loss today, but if we cannot follow a clear psychological model, how could I, a relatively young guy with not that much experience of dramatic loss, how could I talk to a congregation of people, most of whom have experienced loss far more deeply than I? Certainly, I can't do it by relying on my wisdom or on my wealth of knowledge or life experience. Rather, I want to look at it from a specifically Christian understanding that takes into account the experience and pastoral work that has been done. One of the books I've read about grief and loss is one of the best books, I think, is called A Grace Disguised, How the Soul Grows Through Loss, and it's by Jerry Sitzer. The life of this theology professor was torn apart when a drunk driver swerved over the center line, causing a crash that killed his mother, his wife, and one of his four children. As a result of this experience, he researched and thought about human loss. In his experience, it is important how we respond to loss. Experiencing loss and grief is not just being tossed about by uncontrollable forces. We cannot make the loss go away, but we have some ability to respond to it. And our God has the ability to work His grace through our loss. When we experience a tragic loss, nothing will be as before. But there is the possibility that we will find our souls healed, as they can only be healed through suffering. Catastrophic loss precludes recovery. It will either transform us or destroy us, but it will never leave us the same. As we move ahead into an uncertain future, we carry the pain of the past with us. Sorrow never entirely leaves the soul of someone who has suffered severe loss. If anything, it may keep going deeper. But this depth of sorrow is the sign of a healthy soul, not a sick soul. Facing sorrow is not something to escape, but something to embrace. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Sorrow indicates that people who have suffered loss are living authentically in a world of misery, and it expresses the anguish of people who feel pain for themselves or for others. Sorrow enlarges the soul until it is capable of mourning and rejoicing simultaneously, of feeling the world's pain and hoping for the world's healing at the same time. However painful, sorrow is good for the soul. That's why many people who have suffered sudden and severe loss often become different people. They spend more time with their children or spouses, express more affection and appreciation to their friends, and show more concern for other wounded people. Of course, we do know that this is not the only response to suffering and loss. Sometimes loss leaves permanent damage in its wake. which forever blocks the way back to a good life we once had hoped for. At times, it constricts the soul, makes it less open to the pain of the world and the wounds of other people. The challenge to anyone facing deep loss involves facing the darkness of the loss on the one hand, and learning to live with renewed vitality and gratitude on the other. For example, after severe loss, it takes tremendous courage to love again. After all, who in their right mind would want to feel the pain of losing a loved one again? Jerry Sitzer, for example, wrote that he thought many times how devastating it would be for him if he lost another of his children, especially now that he had invested so much of himself into them as a solo father. He was terrified by that possibility, yet he could not imagine not loving them either, because that was even more abhorrent to him than losing them. While the loss and the tragedy that brought it about were horrible, evil even, much good resulted from the loss. And after all, suffering is part of our life here on earth. Our reading from the letter to the Romans describes ways in which love is lived out in the Christian community. In that passage, we read that Christians are to rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. The ability to do that springs from our own brokenness, from our own suffering, which also allows us to rejoice more deeply. The reading also encourages us to work for the good even in the face of catastrophic loss. Do not take revenge, for revenge is another response to loss in situations where we feel we can lay the blame directly at the feet of others. But that would add to the misery of the world, would add evil to evil. God calls us towards a different way. After all, God so humbled himself and became obedient to death, even to suffering on a cross. The incarnation means that God cares so much that he chose to become human and suffer loss, though he never had to. So I hope we can also find comfort knowing that the sovereign God, who is in control of everything, is the same God who has experienced the pain we live with. God understands suffering because God suffered. Now, before I come to the close of the sermon, I want to briefly look back upon these last few weeks as we made our way through the books of Samuel. According to the lectionary, we finish our readings of the books of Samuel today. We could go on to the books of Kings, but I think we'll leave that for another year and concentrate on the Gospels for a bit. So we've covered a lot in these weeks, from looking at how this world is both directed by human confusion and God's providence, to the death of our dreams, to dancing in joy before God, to recognition and repentance of our sins. These books led us through our human experiences. I do hope that you can see how books that are filled with strange stories can nevertheless show us the reality of our lives here in the world and our relationship with God in all its complexity. So as we think about loss and grieving, and as we reflect about how to respond to the sorrow we face in this world, I want to close with the words from a song by Michael Card. In any split second of a moment of time, in the blink that is one single day, the sum of the sorrows that wraps around the world could catch every soul up and sweep them away. As vast as the ocean, as deep as the sea, swept up in one toxic tide, by warm, salty waves, the world weeps its woe. So how could it be that my own eyes are dry? So open my eyes and open my heart, and grant me the gift of your grieving, and awaken in me the compassion to weep, just one of the tears of the world. When God walked among us in the fullness of time, he wept tears as old as the world. Acquainted with sorrow, he took up the cup and drank every drop of the poison that heals. And so comes the call of this sorrowful man to set our small sadness aside, to come now and follow, no matter the cost, to follow him boldly and wade in the tide. So open my eyes and open my heart and grant me the gift of your grieving and awaken in me the compassion to weep, just one of the tears of the world.